morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Sarah Neidhart, author of the memoir 20 Acres, A 70s Childhood in the Woods from the University of Arkansas Press. The book recounts Sarah's experience growing up as part of a back-to-the-land family in a small, isolated town in the Arkansas Ozarks. Sarah and her family lived there from 1973 to 1981, building a modest cabin and raising and growing their own food. To write the book, Sarah drew on her own memories as well as an archive of family letters, photos, and cassette recordings from that time. We're also fortunate to have Sarah's mom, Wendy McPhee, in the studio with us. Wendy figures prominently in the book, and I'm grateful she's here to add her take on Sarah's account. Please join us for our conversation with Sarah and Wendy, which is already in progress. Well, Sarah and Wendy, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios. It's a treat to have you both here to talk about Sarah's book.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Sarah, let's start with you. Most of 20 Acres takes place in a small, somewhat isolated town, Fox, Arkansas,
yes,
where you spent a good part of your childhood. But it got its start here in Portland, your current home, and you began going through an archive of family,
yes,
letters, photographs, audio cassettes. How'd you gather all the material?
Well, I knew my mother had them. I'd seen them when we all lived in California a little bit. I'd seen some stray things here in a drawer. They weren't very well organized for a time. I knew there was maybe some envelopes that she had with a bunch more in it. But it wasn't until she moved to Portland and I started really going through the letters. I decided I want to read all these. I want to gather them all together. And when I started really reading them all sequentially and then I transcribed them, then that's when
I
knew I had
something
more.
How many letters were that? Hundreds?
I think there are about 100 letters.
Wow.
Probably.
That's a lot of background work there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
When looking through the collection, what inspired you to turn it all into a book?
I already had been kind of playing with the idea of a book about this story. I had taken a nonfiction class in California and kind of written some essays on it, but I hadn't really been able to take it very far beyond sort of some unformed essays. But when I read the letters and sort of sequentially rather than just sort of one here and one there, I really saw a story arc. And that's when I knew, oh, I can combine all these memories and thoughts that I've been accumulating with all these letters and some other archival documents, but we had some audio cassettes from that time.
Yeah, amazing, because that was kind of the birth of audio,
yeah,
cassettes and the little reel-to-reel.
The little black.
Well, cassette machines. Even,
yeah, the little cassette
coming
recorder.
In, I think, late 60s they came in.
So we had those still. And that's when I knew I had enough to turn it into a book. And that's when I really dedicated myself to doing that.
And you've said that you started writing the book when your son started kindergarten. That was around 2013. So that was just you had more time.
I just suddenly had more time. And that's when I really stopped just playing at it here and there and really started dedicating lots of time to it.
So you had all this material and your memories, which are basically impressionistic. I mean, all our memories,
definitely,
moments,
yeah,
that stand out for you and not necessarily in chronological order.
Absolutely.
And your task writing a memoir is to turn this into a narrative, to connect the dots, in effect. Were there other memoirs that inspired you or maybe served as a blueprint?
You know, for better or worse, I have always loved biographies, mostly biographies of writers and women. So I was definitely inspired by biographies. And I read the book Annie John, Jamaica Kincaid, that kind of...
Oh, yes, I know the author, but I don't know the book.
It's just a little small story of a child, and I was already playing a lot with my childhood memories in a childish way. I wanted to think like my child self in some ways, but not write a book. I mean, my book is very different from Annie John. But anyway, that there are pieces of that that inspired me, a child's vision of the land and the people around her. But I think biographies, honestly, were some of the... I read a biography called Them, which was Francine Duplessix Gray, I think,
oh, yes,
is her name,
uh-huh,
that she wrote about her parents. That also, it's kind of like a pretty standard biography, but that, I think, it was something I had read at one point that I really loved, and I loved the idea of unpacking parents, them.
We'll talk about that, because I wanted to get your take on how your impressions changed. Your parents became real people,
yeah,
during the writing,
yeah,
of the book, I'm sure, or much more
so
dimensional.
More so than before, yeah.
Many more dimensions to them. Now, the book itself, what struck me is it's not only a memoir, but in some ways a story about writing a memoir. Was that something, a conscious decision on your part?
You know, that really wasn't. It wasn't really. But I think it does become part of the process because you're figuring out how to unpack your memories and other people's memories, how to then stitch that all together. It's a puzzle. And so in a sense, the mechanics of it are so much a part of the process that it gets into the book.
Yeah, and especially in your process where you've got all this material, archival material.
Exactly.
To work from.
Archival material in particular lends itself to that because it really is part of the process. It's an exciting, it's a little bit like true crime. Sort of.
Yes, and it's nice to let the reader in on that.
Yeah.
How you came to this point.
Right.
Now, Wendy, when Sarah started writing the book, I think, were you both living in Portland at the time? It was about 2013, or were you still in the Bay Area?
Yes, we were both living in Portland.
How and when did she first tell you about it? You knew she had your letters, but you didn't know she was going to turn that into a memoir at the time.
I feel like I knew about it for a long time, but I'm not sure.
It's because I think I'd been sort of talking about wanting to do this. It hadn't really come, it wasn't really a serious conversation yet. It had just been something that I was always playing with or had been for quite a few years. So it probably just sort of flowed in together.
And I remember something that she wrote, just a beginning, and really before she went through all the archival material. And I thought it was so beautifully written.
Wow. So, Sarah, you were showing parts of the book.
Yeah, I think that was probably when I took a nonfiction class through UC Berkeley Extension in the Bay Area back in like 2003 or 2002 or something. And I wrote some things in there. And that's probably what I shared with her then, was what I had written there. And some of those pieces definitely made it into the book, the final book.
Now, Wendy, when you gave Sarah your letters, you weren't quite sure what she was eventually going to do with it other than read it for her own personal use. Were you concerned about guarding some of your more private moments?
No, not really.
You're an open book.
I wasn't. There was nothing that concerned me, really. I don't know why, but it didn't.
My parents are very remarkably unguarded people, I would say.
Now, from what I read and what you just told me, you were very supportive during the writing and apparently an active participant in Sarah's research, not just the letters you sent her, but Sarah, you were going back and forth with phone conversations, email, and texting.
Definitely.
You're
all
kind
the
of
time.
The more modern technology.
Yeah, a lot of texting. Are you sure? Did it smell like, what do you think it smelled like when you things like that? Sometimes it was down to that level of nitty gritty over text with both my parents.
Yeah, she interviewed both of us extensively, as though we were strangers, really.
Now, Wendy, we mentioned the writing of the book started here in Portland, the actual writing in 2013, but the story behind the book, how your family got to Arkansas, started aptly enough at a bookstore, Chinook Bookshop in Colorado Springs. That's where you met your husband, Richard Neidhart, Sarah's dad, in the summer of 1969. What do you remember about that first meeting?
Well, when he and I met, it was just we were both going to work together, and I don't think there was too much thought, But very quickly we were attracted to one another.
Now, the summer of 69, when you met Richard, was a very intense time in American history. And I'll quote from Sarah's book. The papers were covered in catastrophe, news of Vietnam, riots and police shootings, economic disaster, political corruption, and widespread pollution. Ah, the good old days, huh?
Yeah. Hard to imagine.
Right, yes, isn't it? There was a real sense, and this is still quoting from the book, among young people in particular, that American capitalism had failed, that the modern world had corrupted humanity, and that the way forward was to return to handiwork and self-sufficiency in place of mass production. Did you and Richard share those feelings?
Yes, but I think it was, in a way, unspoken, but definitely the feeling that you needed to drop out, you needed to get away. It wasn't like we spent hours discussing it, but I definitely...
And making plans.
Richard wanted to move to the woods first. He was the one who had the whole idea, and I was somewhat reluctant. But that feeling of getting away from everything, the way America was running, we wanted everything to be different, more real, more natural, more organic. I don't know, just more... less city, more natural.
And as we'll find out, you got a lot of that.
Yeah, we got more than we planned on.
Maybe an overdose.
Absolutely.
Now, after you met, you and Richard married 2 years later, 1971. Sarah later found out you had plans to go to grad school
at UC Berkeley and studied to become a teacher, I think. But you decided to stay with Richard in Colorado Springs at that time. Why the change in plans? Love?
Yeah, love. I think that I wanted to be married, to be honest about it. And I've been seeing some things that happen in the 50s, and I've been thinking about the fact that back then, the pressure on a woman to be married was high, even though my parents didn't necessarily put pressure on me. But I wanted to be married. I wanted to have a family.
And you were about 24, 25 at the time.
I was 25, yeah. So not that I thought I wasn't worried about being an old maid or anything like that, but I think I did want to get married, and that was much more exciting than going to graduate school.
Now, in the book, Sarah includes a poem you wrote and gave it to Richard on New Year's Eve, 1970. I thought it was beautiful. I wonder if you would read it for us.
I would love to, and I thank you for the compliment. Whom do you love now, sweet Richard? I threw your love away like paper. Want to open it again, unfold you in the darkness of your room. Ah, pale suitor, since I left you, see my emptiest self reflected in your eyes. This sullen heart, an only mirror to the past. Whom do you love now, sweet Richard?
Does that bring back memories?
Yes. I mean, I had broken up with him, and that's why I wrote that.
You were the one that
decided
on the breakup.
Uh-huh. And then I realized I'd made a mistake, yeah.
Well, as a testament to your poetry and your love for each other, you were married less than 3 months later, March 1971.
Correct, yes.
Very effective. So, listeners out there, poetry works. Now, Sarah, your dad had quite an adventurous life before coming to Colorado Springs. He enrolled at the University of South Carolina, where he lived, had run-ins with the white Christians there, including a Ku Klux Klan recruiter, played folk and blues guitars in local coffee houses. They had coffee houses and music then, and hitchhiked to New York City to hang with the Beats and the Folkies. You know, people who have recently seen the Dylan biopic, Complete
it's
Unknown,
exactly
would
that.
Know that scene.
Yeah,
in
it's
New
that
York.
Scene, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he even had a stint in the Army before returning to Colorado Springs.
Yes, he did.
That was to avoid selective service at the time.
He got drafted.
Oh, he got drafted.
He did get drafted.
But he enlisted, though, to avoid
He enlisted draft? Before. Yeah, I guess the way it works is you get your draft. He got drafted.
Oh,
he
that's
tried
right.
to get out of it, actually, by telling them about all his rampant drug use and a motorcycle injury he'd had.
It didn't work because every other recruit had the same thing.
Exactly. So it didn't work. And he got advice that you're best to just enlist now. Don't wait for them to call you because you'll get the best positioning that way. And that worked out very well for him. That ended up being the right thing to do because he got good test scores and he was able to pick what he wanted to do and he avoided going to Vietnam for that reason.
And he went to Germany and he married and divorced. And there,
all in that
there
short
he
time.
Was jilted again.
Yes, yes.
His wife left him for another man in Germany.
Yeah.
What a background. And then he returns to Colorado Springs. Now, Sarah, you were born in January 1972, so 10 months after your parents married.
Yeah.
And your parents were still working at the Chinook Bookshop in Colorado Springs. In early summer that year, your dad met a leather worker named Larry. He met him at a leather shop near the bookstore. And Larry was visiting from his home in Fox, Arkansas. And that encounter kind of sets everything in motion.
Exactly.
Can you tell us how that led to you all ending up in Fox?
Yeah, Larry and all the other, you know, hippies on the little shops in downtown Colorado Springs were, you know, sitting around smoking dope and drinking beers. And Larry left his keys in his truck, and his truck was stolen. And he needed a ride back to Fox.
Colorado Springs wasn't exactly Arkansas.
It wasn't exactly Arkansas. Yeah. You couldn't just leave your keys in the truck. And so Daddy, and I apologize, I do still call my dad Daddy, which always, I flinch when other people do it, but I can't help myself. But anyway, Daddy and a friend of his decided, sure, we'll drive you back. And Larry had been talking about how wonderful the Ozarks were. He really painted it as just this utopia, beautiful outdoors region.
And you say in the book that your dad was attracted to two of his passions, music and caving.
And music and caving, which were both big in this area of the Ozarks. And so they drove him back. My mom and I came. I was, I guess, like 6 months old. We went that summer. And we never looked back. Or not for very long.
Wendy, on that drive to Arkansas, the Ozarks, with Richard, Larry, his partner and friend Ray, and baby Sarah, you're described in the book, Sarah describes you as reticent. Were the plans to move there, or did that come after you arrived, or did you kind of get that feeling that Richard was going to get hooked?
I don't think I thought very far ahead about anything in those days, because I don't think I had those many thoughts. But I do remember driving in the car and Sarah, and I was mostly worried about Sarah, this little tiny baby shaking really sometimes from this long drive. And when we got there, yeah, it was hot and humid, and the baby there had sweat on her face, which is nothing, but I thought it was something terrible.
Something different than Colorado.
I thought, oh my God. And then he told me, I've signed up, you know, for us to get a place. And I said, I'm not sure that I'm ready for this. And he said, but would you ruin my dream? And I went, okay, no, I don't want to do that.
He played the dream card.
He played the dream card. And so I was definitely a follower in those days, is all I can say. I just felt out. Yeah, I felt this is what he wants, and I wasn't really against it, but I definitely wasn't really for it. And the South was, he was from the South, but you know,
from South Carolina.
The heat and humidity was a shock to me.
In the book, too, you mentioned the heat there and the humidity, but you also spent a night in a rundown farmhouse in the woods. Oh, I think Dulcimer Maker was your host. She owned the house. No electricity, and then you were in a tent for the next few nights, and you still, because it was Richard's dream, you still agreed.
I did. But that night, I mean, that's a night I'll never forget. And I always felt like, I'm not sure Sarah really understands how scary it was, because the house had no electricity. So when you turn off the candles, there's nothing, or the lanterns, whatever you have. And
there's no lights surrounding you.
Lights,
there's no street lamps or
there's
anything
nothing.
Like that.
It was black.
Yeah, no ambient light.
And so Richard and I were on this little tiny, I don't know what it was, but I guess a bed, a cot or something. And then I had to put Sarah on the floor in some kind of bed arrangement that I made. So she wasn't even in my arms or anything.
And you couldn't see her.
I couldn't see her. I was terrified. And I don't know. I was married. I don't know. I can't explain it to you now, except that I wasn't strong enough to say, no, this will not happen. I'm just not that person, maybe.
Or maybe adventurous enough to say yes.
I think that's very true. In fact, when I was thinking about this interview, I was thinking, what is it that really made me do that when it wasn't really my cup of tea? It was because I love adventure, or I wanted adventure. And so I did. And I don't regret it, you know.
Now, Richard paid $2,200 for 20 acres of land, and that's where we get the title of the book, sharing ownership with his partner, Ray, and his family. And Ray, I think, is a pseudonym?
It's a pseudonym, yeah.
And Ray's wife, Susan, and their baby, Sunshine, which is definitely a hippie name.
And the real name was a total hippie name, too. So.
Oh, yeah. Rainbow good, or something like that.
Okay. Exactly.
I can only guess. Granola.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, it was a very difficult time for your family, with Richard often working a day job for money while building the cabin, and you were nursing baby Sarah while doing without the comforts most of us take for granted, running water, indoor plumbing, electricity, even a telephone. You didn't have a telephone. Richard's partner, Ray, and his family left Arkansas in July 1973. So just 6 months later, he sold a share back.
Yeah, they didn't last
the
long at all.
Back to Richard and you guys. Why did they leave, and were you thinking of doing the same thing?
At that point, no, I don't think so, because I was committed to get this done. You know, this is our plan. We're going to have a cabin.
And they were fed up at that point.
I'm not saying I was thrilled, but yeah, I think I was still then pretty much, let's try to do it, what we planned.
Well, it seems to me you found strength maybe you never knew you had. That must have come as a very nice surprise. I mean, for anybody to really be in that situation, yeah, I'll persevere here.
I did. And another thing is, my family had camped off and on most of my life. I mean, that was my father's favorite thing to do on a vacation. So I was in some ways used to the idea.
To sleeping in a tent and
yeah,
using a lantern.
Or not having running water, or using a lantern, or being in the woods. I was more used to that than some people would be. And also in my family, everybody wanted to have a cabin in the woods. Now, they were thinking of cabin in the woods in Colorado, but it was an ideal in a way to be able to have that. And they were thinking of it as a vacation place, not where you actually live. But so I had a little more. I had some, in some ways, it was just, this is what we do, you know, when you're in the country. You know, I was more accepting of that.
Now, Sarah, I wonder, you know Ray's real name then?
Yes.
You say in the book that you never heard from him again or saw him again.
Never.
Did you try to locate him when you were researching the book?
I did, and I believe, it's been so many years now, it's funny how my memory is, he had died. But his family, I found his, I didn't reach out to them, but I found his ex-wife who had come with us, Susan, and his daughter. I found both of them online. I was going to reach out, but something, shyness kind of kept me from reaching out, and something held me. I think it had kind of been a little bit of a contentious relationship towards the end.
Oh, because your dad probably wanted him to stay to help build the
cabin. Yeah, and I think they just started getting on each other's nerves towards the end. Which, you know, wasn't like some big, massive thing happened. And I don't know, something just told me these people don't want to revisit this story. And that may not have been true at all. And it's maybe a shame that I didn't do that.
Wouldn't that be great if they pick up your book? And
I know.
Kind of recognize themselves or the late father?
And as I remember, they were still in Colorado, actually, when I found them. So, yeah, it would be kind of amazing.
Maybe they'll get in touch.
Maybe they will. It would be, you know, or somebody, you like... Sometimes that world can be a small world. Maybe somebody that knew my parents back then that have heard about the book, maybe still know them. You know, who knows?
Well, it's out there. There's a chance.
It's out there, yeah.
Now, by June of 1974, you finally moved into the cabin. It still needed work, but it must have felt good to have a real home rather than living in what you described as a pup tent all that time while your dad was building it.
Yeah, we didn't live in a pup tent the whole time. We lived in the key place.
This was not the whole time, right?
We lived in a pup tent briefly when we first moved to the house, and that was when there was a massive rainstorm in Arkansas.
Where you couldn't get around. There was several feet of muck?
Yeah, that happened every year.
Oh, okay.
But this was, we were in a tent, and this was after Katie was born, and it was me and Sarah.
Yeah, and we were just about to move into, we had left this rental called the Key Place in the book.
There's a whole chapter.
We had just left that and just moved onto the land in preparation to go into the cabin, but there was still a period of weeks there before we could get in.
Yeah, there was some time.
So
but
that's
before
when we
that
were in
was
a tent.
The key place, then the tent. That was a memorable night. I think it was 8 inches of rain in the night.
So you were sleeping in a puddle of water, basically, or?
You know, I think it was angled like this, so the,
oh, the we water was going downhill.
Yeah, it was going downhill, but it didn't change the fact that I was terrified for my little baby and my
toddler.
My toddler, but we made it.
Now, Sarah includes in the book a letter that you wrote shortly after moving in to the cabin, getting out of the rain. There, you describe your pride. In the cabin. I wonder if you could read an excerpt of that for us.
Sure.
And it'll be just kind of the first few sentences, just to let listeners know, and then the very last sentence. Other than that, it's a long letter that takes up about 2 pages in the book.
To others, it seems pretty, but small, or just pretty small. To us, at least, on good days, it seems a palace, since we remember when there was nothing here at all, and we know the blood, sweat, and tears that went into it. It is full of mistakes, but the general impression, to me at least, is every bit as nice as the beautiful homes in the wood butcher's art. Many thanks for that beautiful book.
And then we go a dot, dot, dot there, an ellipsis, and a transition to the end here of the letter.
We have never worked so hard or been so frustrated in our lives, but we are slowly beginning to feel a sense of accomplishment and a confidence in our new abilities. And that was so true.
Yeah, I just miss letters.
When you read, they are amazing.
Email's nothing like
it's
that.
Nothing
texting
like
certainly
that.
Isn't. And tweeting or
it's really
social media is
a sad thing we've lost, yeah.
Oh, definitely. I just want to quote from another letter, Wendy, that you wrote soon after that, and this was to your grandmother. Quote, "We feel at the height of luxury, and really we are. We have 20 acres of yard, a house of our own, food plus warmth. What more could we ask?" That seems almost like a peak of happiness for you and Fox, that time there.
Definitely, definitely. I feel that I learned to appreciate the small things in life.
And you had, this was your husband's dream, a cabin that he built, and you were all living in it. And though he continued to work on it, you were in there, you were out of the tent, you were out of the key place.
Yeah, having your own place, building your own house. It's a very satisfying experience.
And comparing it to a palace, relatively.
And I think ever since then, the confidence you build in yourself, that you were able to live in that situation and enjoy it.
Which must have lasted your entire life. You probably still feel
I think
feel
it has.
You got through it.
And if I have a roof over my head, I'm okay. I have heat, water. Oh, my God, I'm rich.
Yeah, that feeling doesn't really leave you.
It does not leave you.
Well, it was hard-earned, that feeling. I mean, you lived through this and you got through it. Now, Sarah, you have an entire chapter in the book called Neighbors, and that's about the people you met in Stone County. And you start the chapter with an old adage from that part of the country. After 5 minutes, you're no longer a stranger, but after 20 years, you're still a newcomer. Now, many of the people you met and describe in the book were very kind and supportive, but you still felt like an outsider?
Yeah, it was a weird sort of dichotomy that they were so kind and so generous and so loving. Of course, I was very young, but I still actually have quite a bit of memory of that, and my parents have shared that with me.
Yeah, the letters and the recordings, too.
But you do always still feel that you really don't belong. Like, it's just never not in the room or in the air.
You had to have been born there and grow up there
and go to the local church. Uh-huh. Certainly needed to be Baptist, I would say, and go to the local church and be
from
a local
family. Your family was not religious, I get the
feeling. We were not religious, and we were not Baptist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and neither one. And
they refer to people from outside as, first of all, from out, they'll say, foreigners.
Oh, really? As foreigners?
Foreigners, yeah. Use that.
And it's not meanness. They're kind and loving people, but it's just you are different.
It's just objective description for them.
It is.
Now, you wrote in the book that at some point in Fox, your dad grew tired of the local hippies, and there were a few.
Yeah.
Among back to the landers, certainly, and definitely didn't want to be identified with them, so he cut his hair and shaved his beard. Did that help at all, or
I'm
was
sure
he less
it did.
Of a foreigner?
I think Daddy was very well liked and accepted. You know, he was doing construction and working with local men. We weren't isolated on our farm doing our hippie things. He really was part of the local economy, and he was trying to make a living. He was baling hay. He was working in sale barns. You know, he was working as a working class man trying to feed his family. And he needed to not frighten those people and upset those people. And cutting off his hair was a practical decision. And it feels better to belong than to always be fighting upstream, you know.
And not only that, but he fit in through the local music community.
Definitely.
And apparently, the town of Mountain View near Fox, so it's in Stone County, you call it the self-proclaimed folk music capital of the world. And your dad played at get-togethers with other local musicians.
Yeah.
You mentioned one song that was your favorite of his, You Are My Flower.
Yeah.
Which I think was made popular by Flat and Scruggs.
Exactly. And he sang it the way they sang it. There have been various covers of it, but he sang it just the way they sang it.
And there was, from that town, I think you mentioned Tony Joe White.
Tony Joe White lived there.
Famous for Poke Salad Annie.
Yep.
And then Jimmy Driftwood.
Jimmy Driftwood.
Well, I hadn't heard of, but he's well known
He's very well known in the folk and country music scene. Yeah. I mean, it's been, you know, I think he's probably not as well known anymore, but for people that really follow the sort of folk revival and country music scene, yeah, he was quite a star in those days. Battle of New Orleans was a big song of his
that was a hit.
Yeah.
When was that? Like early 60s, I think.
I think
Pre-Beatles.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, yeah, pre-Beatles. And sort of fed into the folk revival that then led to things like the Beatles and Bob Dylan and all of that.
If people have seen that movie, you know, Bob Dylan, it ends with him going electric.
Right. And this was a community that was kind of what, you know, the Pete Seegers and the Woody Guthries and then the Bob Dylans and the Beatles that followed, these were the real people that these people were all sort of worshiping and getting their ideas from. We fell into a community like that, this little pocket in this isolated part of the Arkansas Ozarks.
That's where it all came from.
Extraordinary.
Early blues, folk music,
just extraordinary
music,
from a musical perspective, yeah. And still is. We visited in 2023, and it has not changed one iota.
Still the folk music capital of the world?
Absolutely. They have banners actually now on the street, so it's a little fancier now. It's not fancier, but that one aspect feels fancier, yeah.
But it's even more so than it was before.
Maybe even more so, yeah. It's pretty incredible.
Now, talking about fitting in and foreigners, if I could use that.
Yeah.
I love reading about one of your neighbors. His name was Michael Warschauer.
Yeah.
He was the only Jew in the area.
Definitely.
I grew up in New York, a Jewish home. He and his wife were bakers, and they made things like Linzer Torts and Rugula, which I ate in New York.
Yeah.
And he cooked Jewish food and invited you for Christmas dinner. That must have been quite a culture shock for Michael, maybe even more so than you.
They seemed to fit in amazingly well, even though they didn't change themselves at all. I mean, Michael was straight out of a Woody Allen movie. I'm not exaggerating
well,
in any way.
He seemed just like Woody Allen to
us. Yeah, basically. But he seemed to, they didn't, yeah, they lived there long after we left. I don't know. They seemed to just do fine.
They did fine. They did just fine.
It's a mystery.
Did you look him up by any chance?
Yeah, we've stayed in contact with their family. He unfortunately passed away maybe 5 years ago. Oh. He and his wife moved to Mexico, and they had been they lived in Arkansas up until, do you know, Mama? I don't remember.
I don't know the
into
date,
the 2000s,
but
I believe.
They lived there a long time.
In that little community of Mountain View, Arkansas. And they had moved to Mexico to retire to a rural area of Mexico. And Michael, unfortunately, passed away. And we haven't heard from Susie in a few years, so we are a little concerned that she might have passed away also.
What an interesting family, though.
Very interesting.
Yeah, to
couple.
Leave New York and to go into these separate cultures.
Yeah,
Arkansas
and he was
and Mexico.
Obsessed with caving and obsessed with food, which also is what led them to Mexico, too.
Now, Sarah, you and your family, now including sisters, younger sisters, Katie and Miriam, moved out of Fox in January 1981 to a small town just south of there called Mount Vernon, and then to the relatively big city of Little Rock. What was that transition like? You went from the cabin to, I think, a double wide in Mountain View, and then, probably a nicer place to live even in Little Rock.
But. Yeah. You know, what's really funny, when we moved to, it was Mount Vernon, the town that we moved an hour away from the woods when we left the woods, a little small farming community, but
bigger than Fox,
because it's farming land, not backwoods mountain land. So I have strangely have no memory of that move, which I find completely strange. I was in third grade. I have so many strong memories of that time. But for some reason, that move, the actual transition time, I have no memory of.
Wow, because you go into, there's a whole chapter on the kind of the little schoolhouse, the rural school that you attended in Fox.
Yeah,
in that
I remember
area.
That like it was yesterday, to be honest, in many respects. And yet I don't remember the weeks of that move. I don't remember packing up the cabin. I don't remember driving to Mount Vernon. I don't remember any of that. But I do remember I was very excited about the trailer. I realize I call it, that was something the copy editor didn't catch, but it actually was not a double wide. It was a single wide. It was much less glamorous than a double wide. We thought that was really fancy.
But you thought it was glamorous.
I thought it was so glamorous. It had like faux gold mirrors and gold carpeting, and we thought it was amazing. But that town was a difficult transition, though, in that we really felt our outsider status there in a deep way.
Oh, more so than Fox.
Much more so than Fox.
Why was that? Because people were more established? Or?
I think because, one, the country people are living closer to the bone, and everybody's relying on each other. And we also, we grew up there, essentially. I was there from being a baby. We lived there for 8 years. We went to the local public school. We were very much a part of the community in Fox from babyhood on, whereas Mount Vernon, we came as a fully established family, and we entered in I entered halfway into third grade, and just boy, that town was just, if you were not Baptist, if you were not Arkansan, if there was one thing off, you were persona non grata,
and God forbid you were a renter.
And a renter.
Oh.
We were just wrong, wrong, wrong.
So you didn't check any of the boxes.
We checked no boxes.
Now, after Little Rock, you and your family moved out of Arkansas altogether. I think first to Central California in 1986. Was that for your dad's job? Or?
It was actually in 1986 we moved to Northern California, right outside of the Bay Area, sort of is often considered the far north bay, in Fairfield, California, which was a suburban military town.
Is that around Pittsburgh or Antioch or north of there?
It's halfway between Sacramento. It's on 80, halfway between Sacramento and San Francisco.
It's probably changed a lot by now, because that whole area is,
it's not that. I mean, I haven't been there in maybe 5 years. Uh-huh. I went back with my husband and son. We drove through there about maybe 5 years ago, and it really hadn't changed that much. I mean, there's a lot more suburbs have been built up, so there's more housing. But it's pretty similar. It's just a suburban commuter town. Everybody commutes to Sacramento or San Francisco who lives there.
Then you moved to Portland. I think that was 2007. What got you up here? Was that for a job or
my husband,
your relatives?
My husband and I actually, we had been living in the actual East, in the East Bay by that time. I'd been out of Fairfield for a long time. I went up to Ohio for college. And then when I came back, with my family had pretty much, except for my mom, all moved into the East Bay. And we just wanted to find a more affordable place to live. And my husband had done quite a bit of work in Portland. And he said, it's really great. We should go check it out. And we went and checked it out. And we found a house. And we've never looked back. And I realized when I was writing the book that the house I live in Portland, there's only one other house I've lived in as long in my life, and it was the cabin. Oh. Which was a kind of a shocking revelation because the cabin was so long ago. But we've moved around so much, and in my own adult life moved around so much, that Portland, only one other place has been as my home as long, or at least in one single house.
Do you feel more at home than in Portland than some of the other places you lived? Not necessarily Fox, because...
Yes. Again, I mean, the Bay, East Bay, I felt at home. Mm-hmm. But I feel very at home in Portland. I do. I feel like I've sort of found my people. Portland's a good place.
I feel that way, too.
I mean, people talk about wanting to be out of their bubbles, and I do think that's important. But I can tell you, having lived much of my life outside of the bubble is good. The bubble is nice, just for general peace of mind. But, you know, it is good to get out of it sometimes, but we like it.
It's good to see the other side, but it's good to be with people
it
that
can
you
be stressful.
Feel
I think you both have that perspective, but here you feel a little bit more among like-minded
Absolutely.
People.
It's just can be easier. Yeah.
Now, Wendy, you were teaching high school Spanish, I think, in the Bay Area.
Right.
How did you come to Portland? Was that for Sarah? And I think your daughter Miriam lives here, too? Or?
Yes. Well, first Sarah went up to Portland. And I went up one time and I thought, oh, no, I'm not sure about it. Because I think it was a rainy day or something. And I was a little bit like, ah. And
yeah, we call that Monday here.
I know. Anyway, I remember not being sure that I was ready. And then Miriam was still living in the Bay Area, but when she went up, and I do love my children, and so I decided to move. And I was able to retire as well, because it would have been much harder if I'd had to find a job in Portland and so forth. So,
and it turns out you live about 5 miles from each other?
Yeah, if even that might even be less than that.
5 miles, yeah.
It's 30-minute walk.
Yeah, it's short. Oh. and I live close to Miriam, too. Same distance, but... different way, but
now, Sarah, you've said in interviews that based on your experience in Arkansas and also living in Colorado, California, now Portland, that you're hypersensitive to class and
Definitely.
The signifiers of class differences.
Yeah.
Can you talk about a few that you've dealt with? I mean, indoor plumbing might be one.
Yeah, there's some of the more extreme ones like right. that. I think that what I encountered often, food, it can be a real signifier of class, and most of my, I would say, up until I was almost 30 years old, most of the people that I socialized with were working class, my friends. And I was teased a lot, usually in a friendly way, sometimes not in a friendly way, but for the way my family, the foods that we had in our house. And it's often the cheese you eat, the, you know, it was just kind of everything. We had the wrong juice, we had the wrong bread, we had the wrong, and I do think sometimes there's a class component there.
Oh, certainly. When you look at specialty stores too, or even pasta versus spaghetti, you
know? Absolutely.
In a store, we would used to open a can of SpaghettiOs, but we wouldn't do that today.
Absolutely. And I mean, things like we had cloth napkins at the table. We didn't use paper napkins. We never used paper plates. We never had soda in our house. We had you know, art on our walls that my parents maybe knew the artists who had painted them. We were never wealthy. My parents always lived paycheck to paycheck, but we had cultural capital of a type, and you just couldn't help, I couldn't help at least, but notice that all the time. And I also, the having of books, no one that I grew up with, I don't think, that I can think of, ever had books in their house.
Oh, really? And you were in a very literate family.
And I was in a very literate family. My parents always had a massive shelves of books in our house.
And we're not talking just the Whole Earth Catalog.
No, we're talking...
Yul Gibbons, your dad was a fan of Walt Whitman, for example.
Oh, yeah. My parents were both very literary. And we had, you know, literary fiction and nonfiction in our home. And The New Yorker was always in our home. So it was just hard not to, you know, it's kind of... It felt very similar in a way. When I moved to California, many of my friends were the children of immigrants, and oftentimes non-white, you know, people of color, children of immigrants.
And you didn't really run into any people of color in Fox. You mentioned one.
There was one boy.
African-American kid school.
But no, in Little Rock, yes, we had African-American kids and some Indian-American kids, Southeast Asia kids, but not in Fox for sure. But coming to California, there were so many people like that. So suddenly being different felt normal. And I think that's when I really started to think about the Fox experience more, rather than feel shame about it or worry about being seen as a hick or being seen as poor. Suddenly I realized that there were all these people I knew who didn't fit one specific American conventional cultural mold. So it was okay to be different, to talk about being different. And I recognize my experience and their experiences, even though there was this class and cultural difference often between us, there was that link that made me feel very comfortable.
And you're aware if you start judging somebody based on these class differences.
I instantly know what I'm judging. It feels very – and I also feel, you know, I now live in an upper middle class neighborhood in Portland, and I have a very – I would say an upper middle class life, thanks to my husband entirely. And I'm constantly aware of how different that experience is and how different it is raising my own child in that experience. And I find it quite stressful at times. It can make me feel very tense, but it's also just something that I'm aware of. I can't ever turn my eyes off to it. It's always there. And it's the same for me with race, because I think growing up in the South, you know, there was a time when there was a book that was really popular. Maybe it was in 2020. It might have been before that, but it was Waking Up White, I think, was the book. And there was never – that was a hard one for me, because it's like, what do you mean waking up white? I think to me it's like, how could you not have always been aware of all this? And I think living in the South, even in the woods where there were no people of color really, or only this one boy, it was such a prevalent part of the cultural tension or the cultural air that it was hard to not always be aware of those things. So sort of like race and class, all those experiences kind of created a constant awareness of that.
And racism, even if you're not really a racist, it's just part of everyday
life. It's just part of life,
A term in the woodworking industry called N-word.
Yeah, yeah, that was a terrible one.
Yeah, my wife grew up on a wheat farm in Pendleton, Oregon.
Oh, very similar, I'm sure.
Her dad, I didn't really regard as a racist, but they didn't have a lot of black people in Pendleton.
Yeah.
And he would refer to Brazil nuts as N-word.
Yes, that
nuts.
Was also how I heard them referred growing
and
up.
And not even think twice about it, that it was denigrating to anybody.
Well, my father, except for that one use of the lumber yard that's in the book where he used the N-word to refer to this lumber.
And he had to. It was almost like the
technical
term.
It's what it was called. Yeah. And it would have been like mic drop if he'd used the actual real term. But otherwise, that's the other thing that made race in particular, along with class, so prevalent in our lives from a very young age, is my father had been part of the civil rights movement in Columbia, South Carolina, before he left. And so he was constantly filling us with stories about things people said. And so we learned the Brazil nuts, what they were called.
So that wasn't just Pendleton then.
I heard that one. It'll never go out of my mind, unfortunately. And
yeah,
so
I
many
know.
Others. And
I was shocked when I heard him say that.
It's a shocking one. And there's so many of them.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate that my father didn't tiptoe around those subjects. He was very, very upfront with us about it. He didn't censor it at all. And I think that was a massive education that we got.
Did he tell you about that Ku Klux Klan recruiter?
Absolutely.
Because there's not much in the book about that. What did he tell you? He was pressured?
He was. He went to work for, and I can't remember the name of it because it's actually kind of famous, but it's a Piggy something. It's a famous barbecue joint in the Carolinas. And he got a job in college working there. He went for his very first day of work, and the manager, now of course I don't remember all the story perfectly, the manager was there, and Daddy always describes him as having a white t-shirt on with the cigarettes rolled up in the side, and he had a ducktail.
Well, James Dean.
Yeah, kind of James Dean, and then he had like the ducktail in the back. But Daddy at one point went downstairs, they asked him to mop something up, so he went down to the basement to get some mops, and the entire basement was filled with signs all about, you know,
get out,
yeah. Anti-miscegenation, all kinds of crazy stuff. And Daddy kind of like a chill went down his spine like, oh dear, what have I gotten myself into? And then when he came back up, within an hour or so, the manager's boyfriend, I guess, came in, and he was a Ku Klux Klan recruiter. And he came up to Daddy and was like, you need to come to our meetings.
Oh, as kind of, it'd be great if you came.
Daddy felt nervous.
Pressured.
Nervous enough that he immediately left after that happened, walked out front. And I think as he told me, and I don't know if there were somehow he got a call to his father, maybe from the probably weren't payphones maybe then, so he maybe called from the restaurant. His father worked in the same downtown area. And he said, just pull up out front, leave the engine running, and leave your car door open. I'm leaving. And my father felt frightened enough that he felt he had to quit his shift and he needed to leave. And then they hassled him. They kind of stalked him for a little while after that with phone calls and stuff. And so it was a pretty scary
experience. And that was late 60s in South
Carolina. 1963, 64.
Oh, 63, 64. So yeah. Kind of the birth of the civil rights movement.
Right,
around that.
Yeah.
Not that that changed things too much,
no.
As we've realized today.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, after writing the book and going through your parents' letters and recordings and talking with them about their lives in Arkansas, you must have gained, like I said before, greater understanding of them as people, not just as parents.
Yeah.
How has your impression of them changed and affected your relationship, if at all?
Well, I think that I've always had a very open and close relationship with my parents. But I think, one, it made me see their vulnerabilities in a new way, a way that was more like I could commiserate with the vulnerabilities because I've now been through that stage of life myself. I'm now much older than they were then. I feel more protective and of that age that they were and
also you're a parent.
Can relate it, and I'm a parent.
You can
and
understand
I,
what it is
I
to
can
be
understand.
A parent by becoming one.
Absolutely.
Other than that, it's really hard to
it's
explain
hard.
To people.
And I was able to see their 20-something vulnerabilities and things that I had seen before as something my parents did. Now I'm like, oh, that's something a 25-year-old did. That's something a 30-year-old did. And that was actually quite eye-opening. I hadn't really fully embraced that. And I also saw a softer, you know, my dad, who is a very jovial, fun person, but he can be a difficult person and a sharp person. And I was always sort of slightly angry at him for what I felt the way he treated Mama. And I saw this more vulnerable, sort of almost teenage girl side of him in his love letters to my mom, this sort of like homemaking, moody, you know, that was sort of an interesting thing to see. And also maybe it helped me see that this is a person who has their own struggle. You know, he's dealing with anxiety
his
and things,
demons.
His own demons, yeah, that he's a human. So I think it did bring me closer to my parents. Even though I was already close, it made me just understand them a little better.
I do want to add that I felt Sarah's understanding of us was remarkable. Her ability to describe us, to really understand what was going on, I thought it was amazing. And she, at one point, she also describes my father, who was a very difficult person, and I felt she captured him better than I could have of his how complicated he was and what was going on in his personality. So I'm really impressed with her ability to understand people.
Was that garnered from the letters and the recordings and all that? And
I
maybe
think the letters really
present day interviews with your parents.
Yeah, I think it was the letters really. I think helped. And then I thought, you know, and I also think that it's just once I got so almost obsessively enveloped in that world, almost sometimes in a fugue state of like I'm there, it just all sometimes would become clear to me, like, oh, well, this is why they did that, or this is what they were feeling, because I could feel it. And I also could feel what I felt like through similar things at that age. I didn't have to really dig so hard. It was pretty easy to see
what
was happening.
And it must have sparked some memories of your own that
yeah, absolutely.
Maybe were deeply buried or...
Yeah, absolutely.
They were difficult to recall until you read the letters.
Yeah, and the letters were everything. You know, without the letters, I mean, without my mother having written all those letters, this book wouldn't have had enough to really make this a compelling story.
Now, from my perspective, at least, it seems you did a great service to your family by documenting this time in their lives.
I think so, too.
And making it easier through the book to pass that down to future generations as well, like your son. And
I hope my son is so far very disinterested. I hope he gets more interested at some point.
Is
he's 16.
He's 16, okay.
Yeah.
They're interested in nothing that you are at that age.
One of his friends is a little more of a reader, and he did you know, his mother had it, and so he, I guess, started reading it. Wow. He came to me and he said, "I'm reading your book. I don't think I'm the target demographic."
Okay. I love that term.
No, you're not.
They're so darn smart, these kids.
Right. Now, has the book caused any conflict or rifts in the family? As memoirs, not just yours, but sometimes they do.
You know, I've been lucky. Somebody's feeling. Not that I know of. I have not, to be very honest, heard much from my cousins that I write about in the book, who we didn't stay very close to them over the years because we always lived far apart.
Oh, that was the three boys. And you mentioned that the youngest, David, was kind of the kindest to you and the others were jerks.
Well, they weren't jerks. Oh, yeah, when we were little, they were jerks. Okay. They were such jerks. They're lovely.
Not now.
They're lovely now.
Yeah.
But I, Dave really gave me, you know, I interviewed him some for the book, too, and they were all excited about the book, but I actually have not heard from them really about the book since it came out. And so I don't know. It was a much more painful time for them. They all graduated from high school there. And I think there were some really painful experiences. And I sometimes think maybe
that could have been you if you had stayed.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that my book, it shows the dark side, but it has a lightness to it because I lived there as a child, and it was a pretty magical experience for me that's really kind of in my soul. And I didn't stay long enough for it to mess me up. And I think they got a little harder end of it.
Have they told you about the book then? When you bring back some of your experiences, and of course they're in the book too, did they feel that was true to the way they were feeling and experiencing at the time?
They did. I let them read the segments on them before the book came out. And they did feel, they definitely felt that it reflected their experiences. But otherwise, they haven't really said much since it came out. So I don't know. I hope they did.
Their parents were also divorced at that time. And I think that put a
of course,
call
a traumatic.
Over their,
it was just a traumatic time for them.
Yeah.
Now, Sarah, in the summer of 2023, so about a year and a half ago, you actually returned to Stone County, and the cabin is still standing.
Still standing. That was an experience that I'm still kind of, I feel very emotional about it. I still feel very emotional about it, and I feel like I have to somehow get back at some point. It was still standing, and everything, it's kind of hard for even me to believe that I left so young, and yet my memories are so clear. I think I do have a little bit of just that's the way my brain works, that certain kinds of memories have really stuck. And so as we drove into Stone County, I started recognizing landmarks exactly how they were in my head. I recognized where the turnoff to the land was.
And the roads are very much the same?
Everything's the same.
Oh, amazing.
It's literally like nothing has changed. The only difference that we noticed was that Mountain View itself, which is the county seat, so we lived in Fox up the mountain, and then there's Mountain View, the county seat, was just a teeny bit more glamorous in that they now have these little cloth banners, I don't know what you call those, on the sides of streets that say Folk Music Capital of the World.
Oh, okay.
And they have some little baskets with flowers hanging from them. That literally was the only difference. Everything, we stayed in a hotel that had been called, a bed and breakfast that had been called the Dewdrop Inn in our time, and now it's called the Inn at Mountain View, I think. We didn't even have to look on the map. We just drove right to it. You know, it's just like everything. We ate all our meals in a place called PJ's Rainbow Cafe, which had been there when we were there. It was exactly the same as when we were there.
Same menu?
I don't know if the menu is the same, but it must be because it was catfish and, you know, all the things that you eat there. And
I do want to say I thought the park in front of the inn was completely different, and that we never had that thing with people, that many
people
coming.
Yeah, they built something called Pick and Park. So they built something called Pick and Park. So people now come every weekend, and they just have impromptu music gatherings. So you might see 30 people gathered around in different little pockets in this park, and they're playing bluegrass.
So they've got a banjo, guitar,
dulcimer, auto harp, fiddles.
It's a lot of people.
People are sitting on front porches with that. I mean, but the music was big. It still has the county courthouse is still right where it was before, with people playing music in front. And yeah, it was remarkably the same. And then driving onto the land and seeing the cabin still there, it is so impossibly tiny. That was a shock of how tiny it was.
Yeah, but what a legacy for you and your family. And especially your dad, who
built
the cabin.
Apparently they're
still
there. The people that own the land now, and they're living in a house that was built next to it that's much bigger, they're going to try and restore it because it's a little run down now.
As a residence?
Not as a residence, maybe as Maybe a place somebody could sleep. Or,
oh, okay. And maybe Airbnb or something.
Maybe they could. It's really tiny. I mean,
it is really
tiny. It's being used as a shed right now. It was just filled with junk. But
I have to say the road coming in was really quite different because they had cleared out some of the forest. You didn't
there
feel
was
that
some,
was
yeah, no, no, there had been some clearing done. In fact, that's been a big issue in the area. There was some clear cutting, and they've also cleared big, long electric line. What do they call the big power
transmitters?
Yeah, when they clear those big, long stretches.
So at least, more people have electricity.
Yeah, and in fact, there was a couple we went and visited that were there when we were there, another back to the land couple that are still living there. We went out to their property. And which is just stunning, they have chosen not to have electricity because they don't want that clear cutting of their forest.
Oh, that's right. What about the internet? Is that available there? Do they have
a satellite
or Wi-Fi? Or?
And I don't know what they were doing.
I wouldn't be surprised if they did have some arrangement.
Yeah, they are using internet. I know this couple's using internet because he had a blog at one point. So now I'm not really sure how it was he said he's getting internet. But yeah, somehow he's getting some internet, maybe just through his phone, through cellular.
Now, Wendy, back to you. In one of your letters, including the book, and this is from 1979, you write, "I get to thinking that women were not meant to be writers, but now I realize my thinking was all hogwash." I think we could say that on the radio. "And I, as an aspiring woman novelist," and you put in parentheses, "in my dreams only, have hope. I guess I'm living life now, not writing it. Plots abound is all I can say." Did you ever consider writing a novel or your own memoir about this time in your life?
No, because she was writing one.
Ah.
That's the number one. That is one of the reasons. But I wasn't going to horn in on what she was doing. And I knew she could do a better job than I could. I did write.
You're a very good writer. I mean, we could tell from the poem.
The letters are excellent.
Yes.
Well, I did write a novel. I don't like it. But and now I've been busy, but I may go back and finish it. But it isn't about this time at all.
Oh,
it's about another adventure I went on.
Oh, so
she did go on another adventure.
So loosely based on your life.
It is definitely based on my life.
One more question, Sarah. This is for you. I read that your current project involves more family correspondence.
Yeah.
You're working on a book of family history based on this incredible trove of letters dating from the 1840s to the 1980s.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us how you got a hold of all those letters and a little bit about the project?
Yeah, the letters have come. My mother had, after when my grandmother died, we got the bulk of them because she had the letters that her mother had kept. She had the letters my great-great-aunt had
That's
kept.
That's many generations many, going back.
I'm talking hundreds of hundreds and hundreds of letters. I'm embarrassed even to admit how many hours I've devoted to transcribing, and I've put them all actually into bound books, and they've all been donated now to the Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America at Harvard. And it's a very special archive just because it is the lives of women, and they're beautifully written letters and fascinating.
And their intimate thoughts, which is the way people used to write letters.
And they're just amazing. And they took me through the pandemic, I will say. But now I have, from that archive, I am writing a book about my great-great-aunt Ruth, who I actually mention in 20 Acres, who was a child psychologist at the dawn of that era. And she had a life partner, Missy. And Missy was an archaeologist working in Greece. And their story is fascinating. And it's the story of their lives. And, of course, they wouldn't have considered themselves lesbians at the time, but I am approaching it from that angle.
Maybe for survival.
I think it was completely unacceptable. But it's sort of their lives, their relationship, as I find it through the archives, but also just the lives of women between first and second wave feminism. And I have some great letters from 1840 that some ancestors of mine, a man, wrote to a woman about the lives of women, because 1840s is when first wave feminism started. So I've kind of got this bookend. And then we go to the death of Missy and Ruth in the 70s when you had second wave feminism. And then, of course, I was coming of age during third wave feminism. And I'm sort of learning about feminism as I write the book, because I never took courses on gender studies or feminism in college. And so I'm a little bit ignorant on the subject. And I am enjoying it. It's kind of a fascinating. But again, it's that I don't know if it's like an anchor on me, all these letters, or if it's a blessing, but I'm back in them again.
Well, yeah, I think you're doing a service not just to your family, but everybody.
Thank you.
To get these letters out into the world. Well, Sarah and Wendy, thanks so much for talking with us today and sharing with us, as Sarah writes in the book, that humid Ozark air of your minds. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Sarah Neidhart, author of the memoir, 20 Acres, A 70s Childhood in the Woods, from the University of Arkansas Press. And thanks to Sarah's mom, Wendy McPhee, who figures prominently in the book. You can learn more about Sarah and her work online at sarahneidhart.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, February 13th at 10:30 a.m. We'll be talking with Oregon-based writer Lydia Yuknovich about her new memoir, Reading the Waves. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
you are my flower that's blooming in the mountain so high. You are my flower that's blooming.